From CBS News in Washington, Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer.
Today on Face the Nation, breaking news on Ukraine and the mystery of Malaysian Air Flight 370. It's been more than a week since the plane vanished, but authorities now say they know why the plane went off course, and it wasn't an accident.
These movements are consistent with deliberate action by someone on the plane.
We'll have the latest from Malaysia and our team of CBS aviation experts, including former U.S. Air pilot Sully Sullenberger. Then we'll ask the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, what he knows about the plane's disappearance. Then we'll turn to the other big story, the vote today in Crimea and the crisis over Ukraine. What can the U.S. and our allies do if Russian President Vladimir Putin tries to annex the former Soviet state? We'll hear from former Obama National Security Advisor Tom Donilon and a panel of experts about that and the other developments. 60 years of news, because this is Face the Nation. And good morning again. As I said earlier, there is breaking news now on Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov and Secretary of State Kerry have agreed in a phone call, according to the Russian ministry, to seek resolution to the Ukrainian crisis through what the news release says is constitutional reform in Ukraine. That is the sum total of our knowledge of this. It just came over the wires. Our State Department correspondent, Margaret Brennan, has more on this. Margaret, what have you been able to find out about this?
Well, Bob, this is based off of a press release from the Russian Foreign Ministry reading out a phone call between Lavrov and Kerry that just happened. And it's the first time that we've seen any sign of diplomatic give on the part of Russia. So that's why there's some excitement about it. But U.S. officials, U.S. diplomats tell me this is a longer-term process. This doesn't seem to be an immediate solution. What we do know was put on the table in the past few days was this proposal from Ukraine that they would give more autonomy to Crimea, maybe give more protection to minorities, language rights, tax reform there. That, however, would need to also be considered on an all-Ukraine basis, not just the vote you're seeing happen in Crimea today. The Ukrainian constitution requires the whole country to vote on this. So these are things that are being put on the table immediately today. U.S. officials are urging caution here that this does not mean there's an immediate deal, but we're still working on
sources. Does it appear that they may be stepping back just a bit from the brink?
It's the first sign of any give on any diplomatic front. Also, we had that announcement of sort of a pause in terms of dealing with the Ukrainian military until the 21st. That is a key date because that is when the Russian Duma is set to review this proposal to formally annex. So we might see some movement in the next few days, something short of annexation, but it doesn't look like Putin's pulling back fully.
Okay, Margaret, we're going to give you a chance to get off and get back on the phone and see what other details you can turn up on this. So we'll cover this as the details come in. Now we want to go to the other big story, and that is the latest developments on that missing Malaysian jetliner. Today, authorities tell us they have expanded the search area even further. Seth Doan is in Kuala Lumpur this morning, has the latest on that.
Good morning to you, Bob. Yes, as this search has expanded by sea and by air, it is now also expanding significantly on land as well. And investigators here in Malaysia are increasingly looking at the people on board that plane. Over the weekend, police searched the homes of the pilot and co-pilot. Inside this pilot's home, they found a flight simulator, which they confiscated, and now investigators are evaluating that. Also, ground staff and engineers, anyone who had contact with that plane, are now caught up in questioning and caught up in this investigation. This as the Malaysian Prime Minister over the weekend said that he believed that evidence pointed to a deliberate act, someone on board that plane deliberately cutting the communication system of that plane. We also learned that the plane may have flown much further than we originally understood. The Prime Minister said that the last signal from the plane came to a satellite 7.5 hours after it took off. And authorities have distributed a map that shows two arcs, almost two giant corridors from which that satellite ping might have come, one stretching in a northern direction from northern Thailand through western China all the way to Kazakhstan, and then in the southern arc stretching past Indonesia and well out into the very deep southern Indian Ocean. This, of course, Bob, expands this search from 14 countries to 25.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Seth. And joining us now from San Francisco, retired U.S. Air Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger, who made that miraculous landing on the Hudson River 5 years ago. He's now our CBS News aviation and safety expert. Here with us in the studio, two more experts, the former head of the National Transportation and Safety Board, Mark Rosenacker, who is now a CBS News analyst and security analyst, and our own Bob Orr, who's been covering this story since the plane went missing over a week ago. Well, Bob, you were making the point a while ago. I mean, the more we get into this, the larger the area they're searching. You were saying we're now searching an area that goes from Kazakhstan all the way down to Australia.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, we're covering now a great part of the globe, looking for a plane that looks large when you see it on a runway, but connected to the or next to the Indian Ocean, it's just a speck. Bob, look, a week after this plane went missing, nobody can tell us with any authority where it went or why it went where it did. And now it's just a painstaking process where patience is going to be required for people that want answers right now.
Sully, walk us through this thing. We're now told that they're investigating the pilot and the co-pilot. Why has the investigation, in your view, taken that turn?
Bob, this is already one of the most remarkable episodes in the entirety of aviation history, and we're not by any means close to the end of it yet. But the aviation industry never willingly tolerates this level of ambiguity. You can be assured that great efforts, huge sums will be expended to solve this mystery, even though it's likely to take months or years. You know, absent finding the airplane and having physical evidence to look at, absent finding and analyzing what's on the recorders, they have to look in every other way, in old-fashioned detective work, trying to piece together this really puzzling situation.
You were an investigator, Mark. What should they be looking for now? Why is it they're just now getting around to looking into the backgrounds of the pilots?
Well, this is an extraordinary situation, as Sully said. We have not seen this kind of investigation held ever, at least in the history that I have been involved in it. We need to see everything. Since this is now becoming more a look at a criminal or terrorist type of activity rather than accident, and still accident is not off the table until we find a debris field, until we find a site where, in fact, the aircraft is on the ground, we do not know anything other than the kinds of information which has been provided us and provided, unfortunately, very late in the game by the Malaysian government. We learned something this morning, which we should have learned much earlier. From the Malaysian Airlines, they told us that this had the appropriate amount of fuel, not anymore. Well, when you figure 6.5 hours to get to Beijing, then add some in for the alternate site, then add 45 minutes in case you needed it in emergency, we're looking at anywhere between 8 and 8.5 hours. That should have begun the process of trying to figure out where we might be looking during that period of time.
Sully, I want to ask you, one of the things we have, we now seem to know that the plane at one point went to 45,000 feet, which is beyond where this aircraft should be going, and then went down to as low as 25,000 feet. How would you explain that? What does that suggest?
There are no operational reasons that I can think of that would explain it. There are reasons that one might end up in that situation, but again, I have no knowledge of what their motivation might have been, of who was actually in control of the airplane, their level of skill, or why these excursions of altitude would have taken place.
Or, Bob, maybe nobody was in control.
Well, no, I think the evidence from satellite and radar, Bob, seems to show that somebody was flying the airplane, and for quite a long period of time, that it changed course, it changed altitude. This didn't look like an airplane completely out of control by any means. The thing that you have to remember here is while we can't point to the pilots, and you can't point to a hijacking or a rogue pilot act, what I think we can say is whoever disabled those systems, if it was done intentionally, and whoever changed the course of that airplane and flew to a spot where they knew they had no radar coverage, there was some level of knowledge, some sophistication, a knowledge about how that plane worked, how systems worked, and how you would want to go about being undetectable.
Mark, how is it that if this plane was, let's say, hijacked, or if it was going through all these contortions, wouldn't we have heard something from somebody's cell phone on that airplane?
Well, certainly not the cell phones. The cell phones begin
really...
They just don't work at that altitude. What I am really disturbed about is once this transition was not captured by the Vietnamese, once they, in fact, saw some kind of a turn and flying over Malaysia for more than an hour, perhaps as much as an hour and 10 to 15 minutes, where was the Malaysian Air Force? Where were they to not come up, do an interception, and try to figure out what was going on? This is absolutely extraordinary to have an airliner fly over that area without the Malaysian Air Force trying to understand what it was.
Suddenly, could it be, and I mean, this is just conjecture and speculation, could it be these pilots were trying to steal this airplane, or somebody was trying to steal it and fly it to some point? I mean, I don't understand anything about this story.
You know, many of the possibilities verge on a spy novel kind of situation. We simply don't know. Those things that you mentioned are theoretically possible. The real frustration is that we are learning more about this, as Mark and Bob have said, very late in the process. And with the passage of time, it makes the variability in the search much greater, and it makes it much harder, ultimately, to find out what really did happen.
Bob, do you think it's possible we may never find this wreckage, may never find this?
If you'd asked me that a week ago, I would have said no. We would find some debris. We would eventually trace the debris back to the wreckage field. I think as time goes on, Bob, with an area this large to search, I think it is possible, as hard as it is to believe, that we may never find the plane. And if we don't find the plane, if we don't find some kind of conclusive analytics evidence on the police side, I think there is a chance we might not know.
All right. Well, I want to thank all of you this morning. Thank you, Captain Sullenberger. And we're going to go now to Indianapolis, where the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, is standing by. Mr. Chairman, have you been briefed? What about U.S. intelligence agencies? Are they playing any part in this, or have they been brought into it in any way?
You might expect that we want to find out exactly if there was some terrorist nexus or some other nexus that would rise concerns to our national security. And I can tell you, just in the discussion you had with your panel, we're creating a big matrix from the plausible to the probable, and nothing has gotten to the probable quite yet, meaning there's still investigation to be had. You're going to have to do a thorough investigation on everyone on the airplane now to make some determination. And the very fact that it may have gone over Malaysia, and I don't think that that's really conclusive, tells you, now you have a whole new wing of this investigation that has to open that will take an intense amount of time, and it may lead to the biggest dead end yet. This plane still may be at the bottom of the Indian Ocean, and I think a lot of folks that I talk to believe that's probably the most likely, the most probable circumstance is that, in fact, it is at the bottom of the Indian Ocean. But you cannot quite yet rule out everything else because we don't have the physical evidence we need to come to that conclusion.
You are an old FBI agent before you were a member of Congress and the chairman of the Intelligence Committee. Is there any doubt in your mind at this point that this was a criminal act?
You know, from everything I see, it's all built on speculation. And by the way, Bob, I that phrase "old FBI agent" concerned me a little bit.
Well, I'm an old Face the Nation moderator, so
yeah, exactly.
An older one than you are.
Yeah. When you add up the plausible fact points, it certainly would lead an old investigator to say there is a lot more to that portion of the story, which is why they seized the flight simulator. Not that it was unusual necessarily that the pilot had a flight simulator, but they want to go through and find out, were you playing some scenarios on that particular flight simulator that might match up to some alternate activity on your flight path? All of that will be done through a really intense forensic investigation to try to determine was there pre-planning. Think about it. If you're going to fly over countries that we know have radar, and you're going to try to do it in a way that either saves the aircraft or crashes the aircraft, there is a lot of planning that has to happen. And if there was more than one involved, there is that conspiracy trail means that people had to talk to each other. All of those are potential gaps for our FBI agents and others who are involved in this investigation, the Malaysian intelligence and police services, to fill in those holes.
Well,
but it's all small, and it's going to take time.
But the fact that he had his own flight simulator, as it were, in his house, it does open up new possibilities, as you suggest. I mean, what exactly was that all about? Let me shift to Ukraine. You heard earlier this late-breaking news that the Russian Foreign Ministry says that Secretary of State Kerry and the Russian Foreign Minister have agreed to settle this thing through constitutional reform of some sort in Ukraine. What did you make of that?
Well, I mean, we've seen this movie before, and we should be cautious. I want to know exactly what was offered in exchange. Right now, Russia is feeling a unique set of pressures other than the international community. It's their economy is starting to suffer. You know, Russia is so dependent on energy as the propping up their economy. Any disruption in that cash flow has serious and real consequences. So if this was just to buy Russians time, I'm concerned about it. If this was truly an effort to allow the referendum to happen, which is what I think the Russians are doing, so that they have the strength in any negotiation with Ukraine, the government of Ukraine, that's a whole different story. The United States needs to take a pretty strong stand in relationship with our EU partners. Now would be the time to try to ramp some of that up as we get to those discussions. If we don't, it's the relief, the pressure that the Russians need to continue to do and solidify their hold on the Crimean Peninsula.
Yesterday, as you're well aware, the Russians seized an area in Ukraine that is home to a natural gas distribution center. This is the first intrusion into an area outside Crimea. How big a concern is that to you?
Well, if you look at the logical strategical areas that they need to hold, from airports to communication centers to the parliament to the military bases, this is that next logical step to make sure that they cannot interfere with the successful delivery of energy to the Crimean Peninsula. I think that this was in preparation of the vote, meaning that they believe that this vote is going to come out that where the Russians believe that they're going to, the Russian population in the Crimea is going to vote to go with Russia. Well, in order to protect the outcome of that vote, I think they needed this strategic hold. This is where natural gas can be delivered in that region, and I think the Russians believe that was very, very important to make sure that that wasn't a lever that the Kiev government could use against the Crimean peninsula. So I think that's what you're seeing here. I find it interesting that happens. You have some low-level cyber attacks happening, which we've seen the Russians use in the past, and then this notion that, well, we'll have a discussion about constitutional reform in Kiev about the Crimean Peninsula. That sounds like a series of actions that's deliberate and not coincidental.
You said a couple of weeks ago that Russian President Putin was playing chess and we're playing marbles. Do you think he's won this round?
Well, I mean, clearly he has set the table to his advantage in any negotiation going forward. Clearly that's happened. And the fact that we've had a little bit of fraying in our European relationships diplomatically has caused us some real difficulties. And so, if you're asking me, do I think he had the advantage going into this? Yes, I do. Which worries me about what was offered up in that phone call. What kind of concessions did the United States offer? Did we have a relationship with the EU that would allow us to make those concessions? And what are the next few steps? We're going to have to learn that in the next few days. But if you look at how this has played out, clearly Putin has had the upper hand in this. Even though he risks huge economic problems, his popularity domestically has soared, and he doesn't have a lot of great economic issues going on at home. So without this, his popularity is lower. All of those dynamics in Putin's mind mean that he's ahead as he would walk into any negotiation with Kiev, and we're playing catch-up.
All right. Well, many thanks to you, Mr. Chairman. We're going to talk to former National Security Advisor Tom Donilon when we come back in 1 minute. We're joined now by President Obama's former National Security Advisor Tom Donilon. Mr. Donilon, thank you so much for coming. Well, you heard this thing that we know so little about, the Russian ministry saying that they've agreed to settle this through constitutional reform in Ukraine, Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Lavrov. What is your take on that?
I think that Christine Brennan is right. I'd be very cautious about any reaction to this at this point. There's been on the table now for a while, including during the course of the Prime Minister of Ukraine's acting Prime Minister's visit this week, on the table an offer to discuss the situation in Crimea, an offer to discuss the arrangements and Russian interest and autonomy there. But that's going to require the Russians to do a couple of things, including talk directly to the Ukrainian government in Kiev. It's something they haven't been willing to do at this point. And
Margaret,
I also
did point out this is the first time that that the Russians have said anything like this, though.
Well, but it would still require them to actually sit down and have a conversation with the interim government in Kiev, and they have been willing to do that to this point. And this has been a set of issues, Bob, which have been on the table for some time now, including by the Ukrainian interim foreign minister when he was here this week. And I'd add, we see no sign of the operation in Crimea standing down or in any way losing steam with respect to what the Russians are doing there. And that essentially, what they're doing there is they're really executing a black operation.
To the contrary, they moved in and seized this area outside Crimea where these gas distribution points
That's exactly
are.
Right. And I think Chairman Rogers was exactly right about this. This is part of the overall operation. They fear once the referendum goes through today, and the outcome is pretty much preordained because it's taking place under full occupation as part of the Russian operation, they fear a gas or an energy cutoff. Crimea is a dependent region in Ukraine.
I think we make a mistake when we expect President Putin to react to situations in the way that those of us in the West might react. But what does he want here, and what caused this?
Yeah, well, I think President Putin, for him, these concepts of balance of power, sphere of influence, zero-sum outcomes are very real concepts, and he pursues them. And with respect to Ukraine specifically, he had a big blow. He essentially had Ukraine reject a move to Russia and embrace a move to Europe, and he saw real loss here and acted to try to regain leverage and some ability to destabilize the situation, get leverage back in the situation. That's what happened here, Bob. It was a real blow to his concept of sphere of influence in Ukraine. It was a blow to this fanciful idea he has of a Eurasian Union as a counterpoint to the European Union. And without Ukraine, that's not just fanciful, it's impossible. And he's acted here, and he's acted essentially with kind of a military black operation in Crimea.
I'm going to ask you to stick around for part two of our broadcast because we want to continue to cover this story with the breaking news. We'll talk to him some more in a few minutes, and I'll be back in a moment with some personal thoughts. I dreamed I was a fly on the wall Friday when Secretary of State John Kerry met in London with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. Russian troops were holding war games on the border of Ukraine. Tension was building by the minute. Kerry was all business in my dream. He'd come to deliver a message to the Russian, a message with the bark off. He got right to the point in clear, unmistakable terms. If the Russians turned up the heat any more, there would be a price to pay. The United States was ready to act. Ah, yes, Lavrov responded. I hear the first thing you're planning is to send a huge economic aid package to Ukraine. How's that going? Is it on the way? Actually, it isn't, Kerry said. The Senate was in a rush to go on vacation, and the aid package got bogged down in a Senate argument over campaign finance laws and some other stuff. Oh, said the Russian, so the Senate is not as worried about this so-called crisis as you are. Absolutely not so, said Kerry. Harry Reid, the Senate leader, has assured everyone the aid package is the very first thing the Senate will deal with when they get back from vacation in a week or so. Excuse my limited knowledge of how your government works, Lavrov said, but vacation from what? Back in a minute. And stay with us because we'll be right back. Today in Crimea, residents are voting on whether they want to reunite Crimea with Russia or whether they want to maintain ties with Ukraine. Our CBS News foreign correspondent Elizabeth Palmer joins us now from Simferopol, the capital of Crimea.
Good morning, Bob. Well, we've been to see the voting. It's been pretty orderly, well organized. And by tonight or perhaps early tomorrow morning, we'll probably see a result that will deliver Crimea to Moscow. Of course, although it looks free and fair, it's anything but. The government that got the ball rolling here seized power in a coup 3 weeks ago. They've been working with a huge contingent of Russian military and their own paramilitaries to arrest Ukrainian activists, to intimidate journalists, and to stop all flights in and out of Crimea, except those from Moscow. So the international community will have a real case when it argues that this referendum is absolutely not valid, not legal.
Now, Liz, what do you make of this truce announcement this morning that the Russian and the Ukrainian defense ministers have decided to take no action against each other until March 21st?
Well, it's a recognition that these little bands of Ukrainian soldiers holding firm on their bases all over the peninsula are outgunned, they're completely outnumbered, and so this removes the tension from the situation. It shows the commitment that we've seen from the beginning to avoid violence. But it doesn't do anything to change the fact that Russia has overseen a land grab here, which Vladimir Putin will now argue was ratified by a popular vote.
All right, Liz Palmer. Well, thank you so much, Liz. We're going to go now to CBS News correspondent Charlie Daggett, who is in Donetsk in eastern Ukraine, to see what the situation is there. Charlie?
Well, Bob, to the Ukrainian government, they say the situation in Crimea is nothing but a land grab. They say that the referendum is illegal and it will not be recognized by Kiev. Furthermore, they say whatever the results or the outcome of that referendum, there is no intention of withdrawing Ukrainian forces there. Now, in terms of the apparent Russian military incursion further outside Crimea, they said that this is an invasion and Ukraine reserves the right to use all necessary measures to stop it. Here in Donetsk, the city is divided. You may be able to see behind me a lot of Russian flags flying there. And we've seen these demonstrations and protests turn violent over the past few days. Three people have been killed here between Donetsk and Kharkiv, a city closer to the Russian border. Now, the Ukrainian government has blamed Russia for supporting these demonstrations, even going so far as saying that there are agents from the Kremlin that have been sent here to cause trouble. Meanwhile, Russia's foreign ministry said that the situation here is out of control, whether or not that's the case, and once again reiterated that Russia reserves the right to take all necessary steps to protect Russian ethnic citizens.
All right. Thank you so much, Charlie. And former Obama National Security Advisor Tom Donilon is back with us for more on this breaking story that's developing this morning in Ukraine. Mr. Donilon, what can we do here?
I think we can do quite a bit, frankly, and we must do. This is an important leadership moment. I reacted in agreement with your commentary, Bob, which we just heard here, which this is an important leadership moment for the United States and for the West. This is a challenge to the post-Cold War order in Europe, an order that we had a lot to do with in putting in place, respect for sovereignty, respect for territorial integrity. This is a really important moment, and we have to act, and I think we can act. First, to support the Ukraine government politically and embrace it, which you saw the president do this week. Second is to support the Ukraine government, especially now in the short term here with financial aid, to ensure that it can stand up under Russian pressure, which will come. Third is to reinforce our NATO and reassure our NATO allies. And Vice President Biden's going to Lithuania and Poland, I believe, tomorrow to do just that. But very importantly, to really indicate what the costs are going to be to Russia for this kind of conduct, for Putin's conduct here, for this action. And that can be substantial, frankly. You know, you can stand defiantly in this world, as Putin is doing, and define your foreign policy as basically a counter-distinction and wholly negative against the rest of the world. You can do that. And again, you saw at the UN yesterday, 13-1 yesterday, there was a vote saying that the Crimea referendum was not legal and shouldn't go forward. Even the Chinese abstained, their strategic partner. But tremendous price can be paid. You're already seeing it. They've cut growth estimates in Russia by half. The ruble's fallen. The stock market's fallen. And that's even before a single sanction's been put in place. We'll see sanctions on Monday to begin, both in the United States and in Europe. I oversaw the sanctions regime for 4.5 years against Iran. This is a powerful weapon in a globalized economy.
But, you know, apparently Putin's popularity is going up at home.
In the short term.
He is obviously playing to the crowd at home, like all politicians do.
I think that's exactly right, and you've seen his popularity go up, largely through the efforts of a propaganda campaign and nostalgia for getting back this Crimea, which was given to Ukraine by Nikita Khrushchev in the 1950s. There is some of this nationalism which he has built up there, but over time here, there's a real cost to be paid for Russia and the Russian people. It's not necessary. Putin's rejected integration here in favor of kind of standing defiantly, and as I said before, he really has put his economy at risk.
Is the Cold War that we used to know about, is it back? I mean, is the war getting cool here?
Well, the Cold War was a global contest between two systems with an existential threat to the United States. That's not the case today. Russia is not anywhere near that kind of power. But I do think we're in for here, given that Putin shows no signs of backing down here. I think we're in for a very difficult time in Russia-U.S. relations.
Of course, under sequestration, the administration had to start reducing defense spending. Do you see that this may require the president going to Congress and say, we can't do this now? We've got something new to think about here.
We have tremendous military assets under the current budget and the projected budgets here. I don't think it's a matter of defense spending here. It's a matter of leadership. It's a matter of kind of stepping up to the moment here and doing the things that we talked about here in terms of embracing the Ukraine government and indicating the real cost that Putin will have to pay here. And there are costs. This line that you hear in Washington that there's nothing we can do about this is just not true. I think we have all the defense and military assets that we need to implement our foreign policy in Europe and around the world. But this is an important leadership moment, Bob.
You do not see the United States sending troops into the Ukraine.
I don't. I see the United States sending troops into the Ukraine. But I do see the United States leading an effort to embrace the Ukraine and support it in a lot of ways, economically, politically, and perhaps with military assistance.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank
Mr.
you, Bob.
Domlin.
Great to be here.
And we'll be back with our panel in 1 minute. Well, we're back now with our panel to try to make some sense of all that's going on. That's a large order right now. Ann Guerin is the diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. We welcome her to Face the Nation. Bobby Ghosh is the editor of Time International, also a Washington Post columnist and former George W. Bush speechwriter Michael Gerson, as well as CBS News State Department correspondent Margaret Brennan. Well, when you left, Margaret, I said, we're going to give you time to go back and get on the phone and see if you can sort this out. Have you found out anything more?
Well, they're trying to figure this out at the White House and here in Washington right now. What we heard earlier today from the Russian Foreign Ministry is that there's now this broader conversation about finding a diplomatic solution through constitutional reform. That is different from what the message sent very clearly by the Kremlin at the same time, which was, we're not changing our foreign policy. This referendum's still happening in Crimea today. We're going to recognize the results of it. And basically, Putin saying we're not backing down, but we'll continue to talk diplomatically is what Lavrov, the foreign minister, told Kerry today, the Secretary of State here. So it looks like there is a broader conversation right now, but it doesn't look like there's an immediate halt in any way.
Well, Bobby, do you think this means the Russians are just buying time, or is there something significant happening here?
Yes, I think it is a question. It is an attempt to buy time. And I think when the Russians now talk of we'll continue to have discussions about Ukraine, I suspect the Russians are thinking of Ukraine as a country without Crimea. Mm-hmm. I think in the rush for the Putin administration, Crimea is already a done deal, and what we're seeing taking place today with the referendum today is the final dotting of the I and crossing of the T. That's done. What Lavrov seems to be saying, if I'm reading the tea leaves right, is that let's talk about the rest of Ukraine, because there's still a conversation to be had about that.
Is that your analysis, Anne?
Yeah, I mean, I think this statement from the Russian Foreign Ministry is elliptical enough that we don't know totally what it means. It could be as simple as an agreement to keep talking. Well, I mean, Kerry and Lavrov have been talking every day and sometimes twice a day for about 2 weeks now. And so just the two of them talking really isn't that significant. It could also be an indicator, though, that what the Obama administration hoped for out of the Kerry-Lavrov meeting in London on Friday, at least some small part of that might be happening, which is that there could be a second act. After the vote that either Russia would not move for a full annexation, would do some sort of vague half measure, or that there could be some other kind of way to leave the precise status of Crimea in enough doubt that it isn't a complete in-your-face move by Russia. And there's some indication that something along those lines might be in the works.
Michael, do you agree with Tom Donilon? He says there really are some things that we can do, that this talk, that there really is not much we can do when you come right down to it.
Well, I think the response we've just seen hasn't been very forceful. You have Europe internally debating a fairly weak set of incremental sanctions on Russia. You have senators in the U.S. Senate, Republican senators, defeating aid to the Ukraine on absurd reasoning. And you have the president seemingly turning down emergency military aid to the Ukrainians, which seems to have been requested, according to the Wall Street Journal. That's something, even if you do want to turn it down, you don't say that you're going to turn it down. You want to create uncertainty in a situation like this. But I actually agree. I think if the Russians move in a major way, there are steps you can take about military aid, which Donilon mentioned, about sanctions on oil and gas, which really hurt Europe, but also really hurt Russia. These are and also measures with NATO, U.S., military engagement with NATO that could send a real signal.
Margaret, what do you think is going to happen next week? You know, Secretary Kerry said, you know, there will be steps. Mm-hmm. When we last heard from him, this was before this announcement today by the Russians. But I find it significant that we confirmed that they even had this phone call yet?
They have been talking, yes, yeah. Kerry and Lavrov. And when we mm-hmm. landed, Ann and I were on the plane with Kerry coming back here to the U.S. From those conversations on Friday, and he was going to the White House to have more conversations there to consult on what he had spent 6 hours talking to Sergey Lavrov about, mm-hmm. because we know Lavrov refused to discuss Crimea. What did they talk about for 6 hours then? So we know that there are some diplomatic measures underway here. But what we hear is coming in terms of sanctions, this cost that you heard President Obama talk about, it sounds like it will be very targeted at individuals in particular within the Russian government, but not Vladimir Putin's money, not Sergey Lavrov's money. That would really hurt. But this is going to be a targeted sanction. It's not going to be that massive hit. And what we've heard from diplomats is that some of this might be scaled up gradually to match basically the level of bad behavior that continues on the part of the Russians.
Yeah, I mean, they don't want to let loose with all barrels all at once. But there will definitely be some sanctions action tomorrow, both U.S. and European. The U.S. sanctions are actually the larger and more significant in an odd way, even though Europe does more business with Russia. And there will definitely be some in response to the Crimea referendum. But from the U.S. side, they'd like a couple things to happen in concert. One is that they show a force with sanctions, leave themselves some room to add additional sanctions later, and also that they get enough backing from the European Union. Germany is a difficult one there, that it doesn't look like a U.S.-only action.
Now, the problem here is the overall ambition of the Russian argument. They are using Russian minority rights to dismember neighbors and to relitigate the end of the Cold War. There are 25 million Russian minorities outside the Russian border, including in NATO allies, Estonia, Latvia, others. This kind of thing, I think the administration understands, and Europe is beginning to understand, has to be deterred before it becomes even more disturbing and destabilizing.
Well, what about that?
I think the ship has sailed already on that. I think Anne's expression was perfect. It's a show of force, these sanctions targeted at mid-level officials. It's only a show, and it's a show that is designed more for domestic audiences here in the U.S. and for NATO allies than the Russian side of things. I think these are things that Putin can and will brush off his lapel quite easily. For sanctions to have any effect, you need two things. One, they need to really bite, and you need a considerable international sort of unity behind these sanctions. As we've seen in Iran, they've been quite effective. In Syria, not so much. And the reason they're not so effective in Syria is because there is not that international unity. You're not going to get that with the Russians.
Explain, Margaret, why this is harder for the Europeans than it is for the United States, for example.
Well, I mean, remember, at the heart of this crisis, the beginning of it, it was all about the economy. It was all about a trade deal, right? And a lot of that has to do with the ties of the 28 different countries that make up the EU and the amount of trade that happens between them. But one thing we haven't talked about, and the trump card that Putin continues to hold while we talk in the West about the economic punishment he's about to receive, he can go and look and say, look how much money the Russians have in Ukraine, not just government investment, the companies they own there, the debt they hold. So when this war of ideas cools off, they still have a tremendous amount of influence in Kiev, no matter who is in power. So that's why the conversation seemingly keeps coming back to what sharp economic tools can be used here. But unwinding the amount of financial tentacles Russia has in Ukraine is impossible to do.
But also, I mean, he can turn off the gas for a good part of Europe because they're getting their gas.
Sure,
from,
and what Europe would say in response to that is, well, that also hurts him because he wants our money in exchange for that gas that we're going to use. It's a two-way street there. But that's what you've heard some in Congress and others say. Well, let's just try to flood their market with cheap U.S. or European sources of natural gas there.
Which is absolutely impossible. We do not have the infrastructure to supply them with the gas. We have one port that will come on stream two winters from now. So if we are going to replace Russian gas, then we're going to ask the Europeans to stay cold for two winters. That's just...
And I don't think we should discount that Putin is using a variety of methods of international power that he doesn't have to invade. There are special operations now, Russian special operations going on all over eastern Ukraine, inciting Russian minorities, creating incidents. And then the largest propaganda and disinformation campaign since the death of the Soviet Union we're now seeing in the Ukraine, in Russia, and in the West through various methods as well. So I think Putin is effectively using a variety of methods of expanding Russian power without necessarily having to send tanks to Kiev.
Would anybody like to volunteer some information on this plane story? I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen a story quite like this one. I mean, where does this go? Does this have international implications? I mean,
it does have international implications. If this plane did indeed fly over several countries to get to somewhere in the Central Asian republics, then questions will be asked about India, Pakistan, and China as to why their radar systems fails. There's already been international implications. The Chinese are very, very unhappy with the way the Malaysians have handled the whole thing. And given the trade ties between those countries, that's something that can hurt Malaysia. It doesn't seem to directly affect us right now, beyond the point that all of us get on planes. I was on a plane this morning, and there is something sort of fundamentally unsettling about the idea that in this day and age, when I can take a picture with my phone and you can tell where I am by just seeing that picture on Instagram, there's something fundamentally disturbing about the fact that a very modern aircraft has disappeared and we don't know a week later where it is.
Can we talk a little about Syria, I mean, which has gotten almost no attention since these two stories have burst onto the front pages and on the TV screens? What's the latest from there, Anne?
Well, we're at the three-year mark, a very, very sad anniversary of a conflict that very quickly became a civil war, and it has been in some form of standoff for 3 years. At the moment, the Assad forces are not winning, but not losing. They are doing better. They've seized a very important rebel town just in the last 24 hours. But the rebels are going to keep fighting. They are looking, as always, for additional Western help, which help also from elsewhere in the Middle East, which comes in just enough form to keep them going.
I was just a couple of months ago at the border talking with recent refugees from Syria, mainly from the besieged areas. And I think that people need to understand that these are not civilian bystanders in a civil war. They are targets in barrel bomb attacks, in the starvation of whole neighborhoods. Both sides commit atrocities in this, but one side, the Syrian government, is committing atrocities as a tool of national policy to cleanse areas with the support of the Russians, the Iranians, Hezbollah, and where the opposition has not had as reliable international support. It's not a containable crisis. You see the effects in Jordan. You see the effects in Lebanon, which is being completely overrun. You see a whole generation of Syrian young people that are being lost and radicalized, which could be a huge problem for the region and the world in the future. And most of the world is a bystander in this right now.
Putin, again, is a sponsor of Syria. What does Putin see himself doing right now? What is he trying to reestablish the Russian Empire, as it were? Does he feel threatened in some way that maybe those of us in the West are slow to understand? What's going on there?
Right. Diplomats joke, you know, maybe he needs a therapist more than he needs foreign policy advisors at this point. But I think if you put that sort of joking aside, what you see is just very much strategic choices to maintain spheres of influence and to keep the people who are friendly with him in power. You see that with Bashar al-Assad's government. And you heard, I mean, if you look at the whole bureaucratic and diplomatic process that has gone through U.S. policy with pushing these peace talks that we were cheering the Russians on for delivering their guys to bring him to the negotiating table. Well, they got him there, and they didn't do much. In fact, the effectiveness of the killing skyrocketed during the peace process itself. They made a mockery of it. And yet the U.S. has still not publicly said, we're done with the Russians. Clearly they don't have the right intentions in bringing these guys to the table. The diplomacy continues with Russia, and they seem to have achieved what they wanted, which is keeping Assad in power and really hurting the rebels in the process that the U.S. has endorsed.
Have they won in Ukraine, Bobby?
The Russians? They've certainly won in Crimea. Whether they won in Ukraine is left to be seen. They have, as Storm Donnellan said earlier, they have arranged the tables at their to their convenience. Any negotiation now takes place on Putin's terms, not on Obama's terms, not on Kiev's terms. And so, to that extent, yes, they've won.
All right. Well, thank you all, and we'll be right back. Stay with us. Well, that's it for us today. We hope you'll tune in tomorrow to CBS This Morning. They will have the latest on the missing Malaysian air flight, and we'll be right here next Sunday, same time, same place. Face the Nation. See you then.
This has been Face the Nation with CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent Bob Schieffer. Today's guests were Congressman Mike Rogers and former Obama National Security Advisor Tom Donilon. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producer is Rob Hendon, and the producer is Emily Bradley. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stockey-Wayne from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Google+, and Facebook.